Welcome to the Booktopia podcast. I'm John Purcell, and I'm sitting across from former Prime Minister Kevin Rudd. I'm surprised to be sitting across from Prime Minister Kevin Rudd. It's an honour and delight to have you here.
Well, thanks, John, and thanks for what you're doing through Booktopia to promote the book I've just written. I hope it goes well.
It's already going well, so you're already off to a good start. So.
Well, it's just a basic story about me growing up in rural Queensland and what happens after that. So.
Well, it's the making of a Prime Minister.
Well, yeah, it was never conceived of that at the time. It's just what you do. So yeah. You grow up on a farm, you do the things that farm kids do, you go to a rural school, and then your life unfolds. And
you don't recommend that parents go out there in an attempt to create a Prime Minister and follow this book as a how-to?
No, what the book says in the opening line is that this book is intended as a letter of encouragement for young people across our country considering a career in public policy and in politics, because it matters, because you can bring about sustainable change. Once upon a time there was no superannuation for working people, now there is. Once upon a time there was no Medicare, now there is. Once upon a time it was impossible for working kids to get to university, now they can. And despite all the bumps and twists on the way, my argument is being in what I call progressive politics means that you can change things for the benefit of the many and not the few. Mm-hmm. It's never tidy, it's never easy, but the book is designed as a letter of encouragement to those sort of folks.
Because there are people out there right now who are saying, they're sort of giving up. You see it in America, and you see it in other countries where there is not compulsory voting, that people are just going, well, it's out of our control. It's like a snowball going down a hill. It's going to end in disaster, and they're sort of throwing up their hands. So you're saying, don't throw up your hands. Anyone can really get involved if they've got a stamina, the intelligence, the drive, I suppose, and the desire for change. Is that what you're saying?
I think it's being true to yourself, really. Folks have got basically always two things going on in their head. One is, am I just looking after numero uno, myself? And that's fair enough. But the other part of you, if every human being, is what do I do for those around me? And that can mean my family, my neighbour, my community, my country, and the world. And a fulfilled human life is doing both.
Yeah.
And that's my simple argument. And doing it on the public stage is not just through politics, as someone said to me once, Hollywood for ugly people. It's actually a vocation. It's actually a calling to, frankly, open the doors of opportunity to a whole bunch of people who at present in our country or around the world may have none. And for those who run into one of the great brick walls in life, that you've got somewhere, someone and something there then to pick you up and help you survive.
One of the things that surprises many people when I start talking and I try to talk about politicians in a good light, because even those that I don't agree with, they have that sense of vocation. Like, they're not all there for themselves. I mean, why would you? Why would you go into that just for your own personal gain? A lot of these people have ideologies that are different to mine, and I can't really understand them, but they still have the same kind of drive and passion. Is it like that in Canberra? Is it a surprise when you've come from one side of politics to meet these fully fledged humans who have a completely opposite point of view, can argue their point of view quite succinctly and well, to sort of start to deal with that kind of a opposition to your beliefs?
For me, it was never a great surprise. I mean, I'm not a sort of dyed-in-the-wool, born-and-bred Labour man in the sense of I got it from my parents. My parents were both Conservative voters. And you grew up in rural Queensland in those days. There wasn't much of an option. That's what people did. So for me, running into decent people in public life is not unusual, either in this country, Australia, or elsewhere around the world. And there are people who wish to reform the country and reform the world for the better, increase opportunities, economic opportunities and social opportunities. But there are just careerists as well, and we don't have a monopoly on them in the Labour Party. I've seen them across the entire spectrum. And the Australian public are a very canny lot. They may not understand the detail We'll be interested in the detail of each of the major policy debates going on, whether it's the future of clean energy, or energy policy for Australia, or climate change, or the national broadband network and the debate that's been unfolding in Australia on that. But you know, what they're good at is looking you in the eyeballs, on the box, on the television, and they want to know two things. Do you know what you're talking about? And do you believe in what you're saying?
Hmm.
And have you got a plan to do something about it? If you pass those 2 to 3 tests, then people will stay with you. But the Australian people have an enormously well-tuned bullshitometer.
Hmm.
And if they sense your eyeballs just rolling all over the place, or you've just got a bunch of cute lines, well-rehearsed and well-scripted to get you through the next interview, then they spot that at 100 paces.
But why do they do it then? I mean, it just drives me nuts watching TV, watching politicians get interviewed and they stick to a point, or they just sound like they're machines. And yet you see them in other circumstances and they're not machines. They can behave and convince you of things quite well. Why is that the tendency? Are they listening to too many media advisors, or what is it?
Well, part of it's the structure of modern politics and the enormous disciplines applied within modern political parties. That is, there is a party line, or there is a government line beyond which you cannot stray too far, otherwise they'll chop your head off,
mm-hmm.
Or at least dismember you. And so if that's your primary concern, then your freedom for manoeuvre within that will be limited, because ultimately, the argument would go, it's your body of ideas as, let's say, a Labour Party. This is a body of ideas about conservative politics wrapped up in what we call the Liberal Party and the National Party in this country. I've taken always a slightly different approach to that, which is I'm proud to be associated with the Labour movement because I believe in the principles of the Labour movement. I believe in an open economy, an open society. I mean, in equality of opportunity. I believe in humane safety nets. I believe that we've got a responsibility to preserve the planet for the next generation. These are deep principles in which we imbibe in our movement. But I can't stand all the factional nonsense that goes on, and some of the stuff which ultimately led to the coup against me in June of 2010, which is people using factions within a political party purely as vehicles for personal political advancement, nothing to do with an alternative body of ideas.
That body of ideas, I often think that gets lost, because the way that people talk about, although they're both the same, these parties, they're so, and I think, my God, they're so different, and their ideological stance is so separate, and yet when they're sort of thrown against in front of the media, that often people often see them as the same, and I feel like saying, get up and tell them what you believe, because it's a really big stark difference.
There, I believe that to be the case, and part of the reason for writing this book is to understand the difference between what I describe as the cause of progressive politics and how you can bring about change, economic, social and environmental change, and change in the world for the many rather than just keeping it locked up for the few, versus a conservative political project, which is ultimately about keeping things just as they are and keeping it tightly within the control of a few, either in political elites or in business elites, and basically bugger the punter. You know, that's my crude summary of the two traditions of politics. The book goes into that at some greater depth. So I think the other constraint which people in the political process now face is not just from their political parties, but people like the Murdoch media really just have an interest in politics as a bit of a Punch and Judy show, which is whack, 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 yes, no, you know, black, white, you know, dead, alive, up, down.
Mm-hmm.
And they actually reduce it to an even greater caricature than it would otherwise be. I think we suffer greatly from the absence of decent media diversity in this country.
So you've taken time out. You've started to think about your life as a project for this book, and to sort of examine it and to really delve into it, because for those who can't see it, it's quite a large book. So it's and it's volume one, and it covers all the time up from birth to the prime ministership. When you're looking at your childhood, because we don't often have time to stop and go, let's have a look at my childhood. What made me? You know, what are the things that influenced me? So you had conservative parents who grew up in Queensland, rural Queensland, and you ended up being very different to them in their views. Going through in this, examining this closely, were you able to spot things that sort of led you in different ways or moments where you thought your two ideas were thrown in front of you and you went, I actually prefer that view to this view, and it started to build up? Was it so many different factors that you can't actually pinpoint a moment where you started to just take a different road?
I think the truth and the answer to that is that very few of us are capable of objectively analysing ourselves. And so it's useful to have a chat with those who are nearest and dearest to you, because they've often got a slightly different take and, by definition, a more objective take. So here is my attempt at it, which is, as a kid growing up, those teachers in my life, including my mum, were constantly throwing books at me about the world beyond our farming community.
Mm-hmm.
And by that I mean the world abroad. And my mum had never been to high school much, and nor my dad. They were children of the Depression. And so this was them wishing the best for their youngest child to understand the world at large. I think secondly, the other thing was teachers at school who were focusing on what I could do in disciplining my mind and ability to write through the study of history and the study of economics, etc. Then thirdly, as a kid, just watching TV, and I was fascinated by Gough Whitlam.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I was like in junior high school in those days. But I saw this guy on the tube, and he just captured my imagination. And so I began reading intensively about what was it that made him tick as he was taking Australia into a period of reform, into a period of open engagement with China, the rest of Asia, and the world. And that lit up something else in my mind. I think my sense of social responsibility comes partly out of my sense of Christian responsibility, which I talk about in the book, not in some sort of preachy, churchy sort of way, but, you know, if you accept the basic nostrums of Christianity, I don't think you can be indifferent to people's conditions around you or be indifferent to the planet. So I think it's a cocktail of those things.
I think Trump has proven you can, but and still call yourself a Christian, but...
Well, as you and I have discussed earlier, there are some wide definitions there.
Yeah, yeah.
I have a very simple principle. Jesus of Nazareth, the carpenter from Bethlehem, I have a funny feeling that if you put all of his sayings together, he's basically on the side of the poor.
Yeah.
And people who've got, frankly, the arse out of their pants.
Mm.
So that's where my theology stops.
Yeah.
And so I reckon I should try and do my bit. That's about it.
So this takes you... right up into your time in Canberra. The second part of the book sort of leads in a sort of rush towards taking over from Kim Beazley, and then heading into the Kevin 07 campaign, and then into prime ministership. How difficult is it for you to? Because I remember the time; it was extraordinary time. I mean, I had a bookshop in the middle of Mossman, the affluent city, suburb of Mossman in Sydney, and a blackboard out the front, and I'd write all these very lefty kind of things on my blackboard and cause trouble. And when...
Well, in Mossman that would happen.
That was great.
Did you get right up the nostril of the locals?
Yeah, little old ladies would kneel in front of my thing and start to try to rub it out with their tissues. But on the day
you
that you...
Urban revolutionary.
Yeah, on the day that you won, I put up something about... I can see clearly now that Howard's gone, you know, and it was one of the ones that got me in most trouble. But it was for me, it was a really wonderful time, because for anyone who believes in the Labor Party or the left thinking or thinks in ways about other people, going through those Howard years was tough.
Nice.
And it was demoralizing. And to suddenly have you rush in this completely different light. For us on the side of Labor, we're very excited by it, and you have to go back into that period and start and looking at, because you know that what you know now you know what comes, but you also have to sort of revisit it. How difficult was it to revisit that upsurge of popularity from this distance?
As I said before, it's really hard to be objective about yourself because, you know, we are all captured by our own memories and our own direct experiences. And we think, therefore, that equals objective reality. It's our slice of reality. But I think for me, as you said, I mean, the Howard years were painful for the country. The economy was being propped up by a mining boom. And when I raised questions such as, what happens when the boom is over? Where do we go then with the next stage of economic growth and prosperity in this country? It was like from Howard and Costello, they was uttering national treason that a mining boom could ever come to an end. And we didn't have to craft out new industries, new technologies, the businesses, the smart businesses of the future. And similarly for the state of the social contract, work choices was bloody awful.
Mm.
And what it did to people and just treating them like a bit of dirt in the workplace. And so turning that on its head and then bringing in decent, fair and balanced industrial relations legislation, which the Tories to this day haven't been game to tamper with because they knew how badly wrong they got it with work choices. But also expanding opportunity through, we brought in the first paid parental leave scheme. So these sort of things meant a lot to me. But this is the point I'd say in answer to your question. The hard bit, the internal politics of becoming leader, the hard bit of then facing the fusillade of abuse and deconstruction from Howard and his team as they sought to rip my family apart and rip my wife and her business apart and rip me apart personally. I mean, it ain't for the faint-hearted.
Yeah.
It just ain't for the faint-hearted. So to the extent that I can be encouraging of young people in the political process, if you've got the fire in your belly, listen to it and go with it. But understand, it ain't for the faint-hearted, and there's going to be a lot of scar tissue on the way through.
Kevin, it's been an absolute delight talking to you about your new book, Not for the Faint-Hearted. And we eagerly wait Volume 2. Is that next year, the year after? Is it sometime to come, or are you writing it now?
Well, I've written a fair slice of it, but you know, in terms of its publication date, it'll be sometime after I finish writing it.
Right. Thank you very much, Kevin, for joining us.
Yeah, it's good to be with you.
And you can get Kevin Rudd's Not for the Faint-Hearted at booktopia.com.au right now.
Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.